This is 40 AM in 5, a download of 40 AM LLC, recorded at 7 PM Eastern Time on Sunday, April 6th. I'm Chris Bohm, and welcome back to this, our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, the Apple-Samsung patent infringement case begins jury selection in a new phase this week. The European Parliament approves Connected Continent, and like a draft bill recently passed in Brazil, it also proposes a variant on so-called net neutrality rules. TTIP comments over the past 2 weeks, a focus on SMEs, the environment, and ISDS. Greenpeace issues a report on how some cloud network facilities stand on environmental issues. Attempted blocks to social media in Turkey continue through a third week. We Live Security reports on a new Harris poll showing how internet use may be impacted by surveillance revelations, as Google issues its latest transparency report. And like a few of this year's favorite films, virtual reality startup Oculus was also crowdfunded. But first, jury selection begins today in San Jose, California, in the latest Apple-Samsung case to grip the mobile tech world. And it comes barely 2 years after a federal jury found Samsung to be infringing on Apple patents. At the time, Samsung had been ordered to pay roughly $900 million, but has been allowed to continue producing products using the technologies while the case is appealed. In the present case, Apple is suing Samsung, the mobile handset market leader, for approximately $2 billion. At the top of Apple's current claims is a demand that Samsung be forced to pay a whopping $40 fee on every device deemed to be using its copied technologies. This is more than five times the amount of the previous demand. Most recognizable of tech copying claims is Apple's belief that Samsung stole the iPhone's slide-to-unlock function. But also at issue among the many tech claims is that Samsung stole Apple's tap-from-search technology, which permits a user to simply tap a phone number that appears in a web page to them to then have the phone number dialed. But Samsung has also raised counterclaims in the present suit. For instance, alleging that Apple has infringed on a patent relating to how media, pictures, and video are organized on a device. Also at issue for Samsung is a method for sending and receiving data using low bandwidth connections. As the USA Today reported, one of the odd issues to deal with in this case has been the proximity of San Jose and the courtroom to Apple's Cupertino, California headquarters. At only 15 minutes from the courtroom, the previous case found a number of potential jurors dismissed because of their ties to the company. As part of our scheduling notes in last week's download, we'd mentioned a planned vote of the European Parliament this past week on the Connected Continent proposed legislation. The package was adopted by a vote of 534 to 25, and as a part of the vote, on April 3rd, the Parliament agreed to end mobile roaming fees by 2016. With the planned phase-out taking place throughout the 28-country European Union by the close of December 2015. The EU had legislated in recent years to lower costs, with mobile operators forced to cap roaming fees. Last year, the cap for data roaming was lowered to 45 euro cents per megabyte from 70 euro cents per megabyte in 2012. The Connected Continent package of legislation could still change, as despite the vote, the measures now go to the Council of the European Union, which is not expected to make a decision until October. According to Reuters, some sector analysts believe that mobile firm revenues could fall roughly 5% without the roaming fees. However, the European Commission argues that since more consumers will be likely to use their mobile phones as a result, as they travel from country to country, the increased usage will offset at least some of the fee impact. With operators attempting to carve out shares of video streaming and music download profits to offset declining revenues in traditional phone services, Reuters adds that European mobile operator sales are expected to fall in 2014 for the fifth straight year. Another key component of the Connected Continent package was its provisions to bolster Europe's so-called net neutrality rules. These components of the package, which also will need to be approved by the Council of Ministers, would restrict the ability of internet service providers to charge data-heavy services for faster network access. The principle behind the proposed rules asserts that all network traffic should be treated equally regardless of its source. The rules would also prohibit mobile networks and broadband providers from blocking services such as WhatsApp messages or Google Drive storage that competes with their own offerings. Opponents of the net neutrality provisions in the Connected Continent proposal have cited that its rapid development was based upon misconceptions about the industry, in part based upon a lack of technical analysis, which risks harming both innovation and consumer choice. Some companies, such as BT, have already applied voluntary codes promising to treat all traffic consistently, regardless of its source, which to some renders the current legislation both overly prescriptive and unnecessary. The passage of these provisions in the Connected Continent legislation in Brussels mirrors, to a certain extent, a few provisions in the Marco Civil da Internet legislation passed the Brazilian legislature on March 25th. In that legislation, provisions advancing so-called net neutrality are also accompanied by rules regarding rights to privacy and freedom of expression online. Companies storing and managing data generated by Brazilians under the bill must comply with Brazilian law on privacy rights, regardless of where the data centers and the data itself is located. The Marco Civil da Internet bill had been developed as far back as 3 years ago, and the legislation's authors conceded in late March on provisions that would have required internet service providers to store Brazilian data locally. After that concession and the March 25th vote, the bill will now need to be cleared by the Senate before it is endorsed by Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff. A new U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Anthony Lozado Gardner, took up his post in Brussels on March 4th, and as reported this past week by the European Voice, spoke most recently on a need to improve on arguments supporting a transatlantic trade and investment partnership, or TTIP, the EU-US trade deal under negotiation now for over a year. According to the European Voice, the ambassador added that it was not enough to speak of how many trillions of dollars might be added to US-EU trade, but that these benefits have to be made real to consumers and to small and medium-sized enterprises. This is not just about big business. The remarks come amidst continuing discussions on key components of the negotiations, including interest in investor-state dispute settlement provisions. European Trade Minister Carol De Gucht said recently about the agreement that there are good reasons to have ISDS provisions in it, particularly if they are new, transparent, where you have an appellate body, and where you can refuse arbitrators, and also where you cannot litigate from a place where you may only have a postbox. However, there appears to be a continuing division over how such ISDS provisions should be structured, and perhaps how important they are to the TTIP. When President Obama was in Brussels nearly 2 weeks ago, he emphasized the environmental elements of the proposed agreement and the many ways in which the U.S. would strive to lead on these terms. His remarks were echoed by Ambassador Gardner in his interview with the European Voice, where on climate change he said that he saw a misperception that the U.S. is not doing enough. We share the same goals, he added. We are going about it in different ways, but that the U.S. is on track to meet its emission reduction targets through a switch from coal to shale gas, through greater energy efficiency, through federally imposed standards on cars and trucks, and through investment in clean energy. The European Voice also reported that at a recent conference of U.S. ambassadors, Secretary of State John Kerry also emphasized the environmental aspects of the TTIP, saying that climate change has been elevated as one of the very top priorities of the administration. The elevation of climate change as an issue in the context of the TTIP comes as a report was issued last week by the environmental activist organization Greenpeace, praising Apple, Facebook, and Google for what it called significant improvements in energy transparency and attempts to switch to 100% renewable energy. The praise for Apple in the report represents a turnaround for Greenpeace, as in 2012, Apple had been cited in the report, which is entitled How Green Is Your Cloud, as using only 35% renewable energy through 2010, whereas through 2012, Apple had moved to 75% usage of renewable energy. The report, however, was harsh on Amazon Web Services, whose cloud services power many online firms, for only using 15% clean energy, according to Greenpeace. Amazon Web Services hosts network services such as for firms Netflix, Pinterest, Spotify, and Tumblr. And according to the Greenpeace report, 28% of the company's cloud is powered by coal, 27% by nuclear energy, and 25% by natural gas. Of the 19 leading internet companies evaluated in the Greenpeace report, only 5 have reportedly committed to a goal of powering operations with 100% renewable energies. Apple's commitment is reportedly composed of the largest privately owned solar installation in the U.S. at its North Carolina data center, and Facebook is reportedly powering its services in Iowa with wind energy. For its part, Amazon Web Services emailed a statement, which was reported by Wired magazine, saying that the report largely misses the mark by using false assumptions, as Amazon operates, in its words, efficient and highly utilized data centers in 10 regions around the globe, with 2 of these using 100% carbon-free power. Amazon has also emphasized that for firms using the cloud, their own environmental footprint is far more efficient than traditional computing, which uses small, inefficient, and over-provisioned data centers. The New York Daily News, The Guardian, and the BBC are all continuing to report this past week on the country of Turkey's continuing block on social media services. Turkey had reportedly issued an order some weeks ago to ISPs to stop their domain name servers from directing people to Twitter and YouTube sites, allegedly taking aim at both because they'd been used to leak information that had embarrassed the government of Turkey. Since that time, activists have taken steps to thwart the block, which had reportedly resulted in a second government request that ISPs hijack domain name servers run by Google, Level 3, and OpenDNS, redirecting traffic to null addresses. If, as alleged, these latest steps would not close all routes to Twitter and YouTube, as those who use virtual networks or other domains could likely be able to get through. The New York Daily News reported that Turkey's constitutional court had ordered that access be restored as of Wednesday of last week, which would have ended the 2-week-old ban. Although to take immediate effect, the lift on the ban had yet to be implemented by the government as of last week. The Guardian newspaper also reported last week that a number of international authors, including Salman Rushdie, Margaret Atwood, Carl Ove, and others, including Nobel laureate Orhan Pamuk, have called for the government of Turkey to end the ban. The online news and blogging service We Live Security reported last week on a new Harris poll that shows that NSA surveillance revelations may be having a greater impact on online shopping and banking than had been assumed. Stephen Cobb reported on the Harris poll, which was conducted from February 4th through 6th of this year. In it, nearly half of respondents, or 47%, say that they have changed their online behavior or think more carefully about where they go online, what they say, and what they do. Changes to specific behaviors, including use of email and online banking, may indicate a worrying trend, as 26% of respondents said that the events of the past 10 months have induced them to do less banking online and less online shopping. As reported by Stephen Cobb, after 20 years of seemingly limitless expansion of e-commerce, the poll numbers may come as a bit of a shock to some online firms. And if you think the respondents may simply represent geeks or technophobes, the same survey built in a question about the surveillance revelations themselves, asking all whether they were somewhat familiar with the revelations since the June 5th of last year, and 85% responded yes. Stephen Cobb's article highlighted that the 18 to 34-year-old age bracket seemed even more likely to indicate that they were doing less online as a result, 33% compared to the overall 26%. And with regard to banking, slightly more in the 65 and over age bracket had cut back than the 18 to 34-year-old age bracket, approximately 30%. And finally, a higher-than-expected contraction in the use of email was found among those 18 to 34 years old, with 32% responding that within the past year, they are using it far less. The Harris poll data reported in We Live Security comes as Yahoo and Google both reported last week that within the second half of 2013, they saw a decline in the number of U.S. law enforcement requests for user data. However, the overall trend reported by both indicates a 120% increase in government requests during the last 4 years. The Google Transparency Report indicates that the majority of requests, or 10,574, came from the U.S., although these figures do not include those of the type reported by the NSA revelations. From July to December 2013, Google reported that it approved 69% of requests from the UK government authorities and 83% of requests from US government authorities. Google's legal director, Richard Salgado, wrote in the report that they consistently push back against overly broad requests for personal information. But it is also important for laws to explicitly protect users from government overreach. For this reason, Google highlights that it is among a small cadre of internet companies pushing hard for surveillance reform and greater transparency. Karen Gillian, who most recently played the companion Amy Pond on the BBC's Doctor Who, has a movie opening this coming weekend. If someone were to say to you, Oculus, during the past week, and you immediately were looking forward to the opening of this Mike Flanagan-directed horror movie, then you may have missed the news of last week's bid by Facebook for virtual reality device maker Oculus. This Oculus has nothing to do with the soon-to-be-released horror film. But like another movie released within the past few months, Veronica Mars, a reboot of the mid-2000s US television series, Oculus the VR device maker was also crowdsourced. In September 2012, a campaign on Kickstarter raised $2.4 million for the Oculus Rift project from several thousand backers. Flash forward to today, and as Hayden Dingman of PC World reviewed last week, Oculus Rift's position tracking DevKit 2 VR headset blows the competition away. As David Prosser of Forbes Online reported this past week, none of the Oculus Kickstarter investors had put forward money for Oculus with the expectation of an investment stake or any kind of financial return should Oculus be sold. That being said, as Mr. Prosser pointed out, only 18 months after the Kickstarter campaign, Oculus was sold for nearly 400 times the original funding from the crowdsourced campaign. According to Mr. Prosser, some Oculus donors have suggested that perhaps a simple return of the original donated funds would be a good, generous spirit of affirmation for Kickstarter. And indeed, the $2.4 million out of $2 billion would represent only 0.1% of the purchase price for Oculus. It has again been a full week, but alas, this is all we have. You have been listening to 48MN5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from USA Today, Reuters, The European Voice, The New York Daily News, We Live Security, The Guardian, and Forbes Online. Thank you for listening. 48MN5 will be back with you again on Monday, April 14th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.